Welcome to the Dividend Talk Podcast, episode 191, Investing in Uncertain Times. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just getting started, Dividend Talk is the place to be for insights, analysis, and unsolicited advice on how to make the most of your money through dividends with our own unique European flavor. I'm your co-host, Engineer My Freedom, and today I am joined by European DGI. So sit back, relax, and join us as we dive into the world of dividend investing and discover the power of passive income. Hola, amigo. ¿Cómo estás?
I'm doing very well, Derek. I'm enjoying the beautiful weather in Spain this weekend. That's why we're recording on Sunday evening. But you know, it's a lovely country here, and the sun was hot, 30 degrees already. So definitely, the weather for shorts, early in the year, I understood, but it's lovely here. I mean, come on, it's one of the nicest places in Europe, right? If you want to get a little bit of vitamin D, Spain is the place to be.
Yes. Yes. Of course. I go there almost every year. I'll be there again this year. So I love Spain. But look, I don't want to be talking about weather. It's still raining here. It's still cold. I'm only back in out of standing out in the rain for 2 hours. So a little bit jealous. But let's get on to dividends, because that is what will warm me up. But news of the week this week. Shell has been in the news.
Yeah, this one is actually quite interesting. I don't know if you had a time to, because I know how busy you were at work. But, you know, the stock market keeps going on. And there was an interview with Ben van Beurden, our favorite Shell CEO, right? And effectively he was saying, like, guys, you know, for a company like Shell, it's really hard to compete with the big ones like ExxonMobil, Chevron, because they have higher multiples. They are listed also on the American Stock Exchange. So it's easier to attract capital for investments and such. And even also the CEO, I think against Bloomberg said that all the options are on the table. And, you know, you invested in CRH, this cement factory, yeah. Right? And it went into the S&P 500 and it popped up like 60%. So yeah, Shell's share price really responded well on Friday, I think, with 3-4% up in a market that was overall down. And this is very interesting because, first of all, they just removed the dual listing, yeah, and to go to the UK to simplify, but also for tax reasons. But imagine if Shell also would go to the States now to move there. I mean, I think it would be, honestly, it would be good for shareholders generally, yeah, if it gets a similar multiple because it's wealth creation. From the other side, I'm in it for the long run, and I prefer the lowest multiple as possible as long as I'm in the accumulation phase. And of course, and this is the tricky one, there's always sentiment to this, right? Because Unilever, as well here, Shell moved out of the Netherlands, and as a Dutch guy, there's sentiment to this. And ASML was also complaining the other day, like, right, you know, with all this regulation and everything and the way you tech stuff, maybe we should consider a location elsewhere. So there's really, with those big companies in Europe, there's quite some competition because they look at also at their market capitalization and everything. And, you know, they use that a little bit as a threat towards the governments. But, you know, I hope we don't lose these big companies. First of all, they employ a lot. They do contribute to taxes, maybe not to the extent that we would like to see it. But this is a politically very sensitive topic here.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a capitalist, I want those companies to stay in the countries of origin, first of all, here. But I just want the countries to be more capitalistic friendly. Yeah. Yeah. So, but if not, then I'm fully supportive to move, for instance, to the States, because in the end, it's my hard-earned money that I parked there, and I want to get the maximum out of it. So I will let the CEO know once I'm financially independent, and that will be the green light for them to shift it to America, because then maybe the capital appreciation will be a nice addition to it.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot of political red tape in Europe, and you can understand companies that are being compared against their US counterparts.
Yeah,
find it a little bit frustrating. Their share price is not doing as well because we are located in Europe. The investor pool is, I would say, smaller, arguably smaller.
Funds pulled out in Europe, because of their ESG requirements, where in America this may be less of an issue.
Yeah, so like it makes sense that they keep it on the table. I mean, we'll know in advance if they move because they have to announce it in advance. Yeah. And if they do, I do believe it will create another buying opportunity for Shell, because all you have to do is look at the multiples between Shell and some of their US peers. Look at Chevron, look at ExxonMobil. Yeah. And that gap will close, because that's what happened with CRH. They were trading at an incredibly cheap multiple compared to their peers. Yeah. Their books, everything is similar to those companies, so something had to give. My regret there is I didn't buy more, because my share price has nearly doubled since it moved over. Yeah. I think it's actually, in terms of the, it's not a big position, but in terms of the money I've made from a stock, I think that's probably top one or two. It jumped that much. So I think if Shell do something similar, I'll be going to the bank. I'll be taking out a loan and I'll be sticking it all onto Shell.
That might be a very smart thing to do, but you can just on the Interactive Brokers, you can just go into margin then.
Yeah. Just go into.
By the way, we're not advising this, guys. If you're listening, don't ever use margin. We're joking here.
No, it's tongue in cheek, but look, I'm glad that they're keeping it on the table. I'm like you, I'm a little bit patriotic as well. I prefer them to stay in Europe, but as an investor, if it means more money in my pocket. By all means.
But wouldn't you like to reinvest the dividends at these attractive levels, at these multiple? And of course, we know that this is a cyclical company, so the multiples do look skewed for oil and gas company, but still related to the peers, you get to reinvest the dividends at a cheaper level.
Yeah. I mean, they're not at the bottom of their cycle. We know this. They came out of the bottom and probably looking near the top of the cycle. But if they were to move, I would definitely buy more. At the multiples, but I'm not actively reinvesting them at the moment because I think they're not at the bottom of their cycle.
So I've been reinvesting the dividends already for 6-7 years or 8 years, because you can do this in Interactive Brokers, because it's UK listed, so those I can automatically reinvest, and I've been doing that. And I think from all my shares, probably 20-25% of the year is just from reinvesting all the shares that I have. Because also when they went to 12 euro or 16 euro, I was also reinvesting the shares, and you get more bang for the buck at that time, right? So for me, this has been doing really well, reinvesting the dividends of Shell back into Shell, because it has been always at low multiples.
Yeah. Look, it's nice to see them at all-time highs. We bought them in the doldrums at around 10 euros.
Definitely.
That's good. But Chuck, we had Chuck on the show recently, and there was a lot of questions around Medical Properties Trust. I'm not up to speed. I'm not completely up to speed, but they've been in the news a lot lately, and I can tell that because every time I look on Twitter or look on Facebook, they're talking about buying this company again. Can you tell me what's going on?
Effectively, there were two big news items this week. So they have announced a sale of their 5 healthcare facilities in the US to Prime Healthcare for $350 million. And then also they created a newly joint venture, or they announced it, with an investment fund affiliated. I don't know exactly how, but they are, I believe, investing 886 million or something like that, and this kind of confirms that their underlying valuation for those properties was correct, with approximately 1.2 billion. Stock market is now after hours, it's Sunday evening, already popped 12% up, because also at the same time they announced that they are declaring again a regular quarterly cash dividend of 15 cents per share. To be paid on the 1st of May. And we had, of course, Chuck here. So Andy Stoddart was asking about this as well. Like, you know, we now consider it an investment. And so, first of all, you know, this is good news, right? And if you think that the stock was at $3 and now probably at $4.50 tomorrow after stock market opens, you know, people that bought at $3 have made a 50% gain. But for me, this has always been like a value play at that moment. For me, it's not a dividend growth investment story anymore. You can say, okay, you know, the clock starts ticking from now again, right? We are back at zero, and maybe in 10 years from now, this was the time to buy. here, and it is a tricky one as well. I can see where the value is, because if the assets are confirmed, then there's a lot of value here, right? But for me, it's just too hot. I don't mind missing out on this stuff. Yeah, I don't need to be the hero getting them at $3. I'm you know, because I may miss out now. Everyone says like, $3, it's a steal. The assets are confirmed. But everyone was talking about the stock also at $14 and $15 about the yield. And I also had, I said that was also a time that my discipline and my thoughts didn't lure me in. So I also didn't lose that money since then, because if I changed my mindset to this, I would have been in the stock at $15 and I would have probably not sold it on time at that. And I would be holding it at a loss with $11. So
yeah.
This mindset has always two coins of the two sides of the coin, right? So yes, I do miss out on these kinds of once in a year valuation value opportunities, but on the other side, my losses are limited. Yeah.
You know what we say? You can't borrow conviction, and
I don't have conviction for this stock at all.
The conviction is not there, and this for me would be. I'm not saying it is for investors who study it and know, but for me, if I was to invest right now, it would be a hit and hope, hoping that it's turning around and I hit a home run. And that's not my investment style, and that's too much risk for me to take on.
An informed investor would say the risk is really low because they know what they own, right?
Exactly.
I just don't know.
Exactly. And for the informed investor, that's probably a good choice for them, but it doesn't fit my risk appetite, it doesn't fit my personality, and it doesn't fit my portfolio. So I'm practicing the joy of missing out on this one.
Yeah, but same here. But to everyone who made this bet at $3, I mean, congratulations. Just my question is like, do you know when you sell, or are you in it forever? Yeah. And That's I think the question to ask, because it comes to the conviction, right? And if you don't have the conviction, I mean, guys, nobody ever got poor from taking a profit.
Yep. Nice one. Dividend hikes. It's been quite slow the last few weeks after a really rapid start to the year, I have to say. A couple of note: Procter & Gamble hikes its dividend by 7%. That's notable for us because we get nothing with Unilever. We have Agree Realty hikes their monthly dividend by 1.2%. And Costco had a massive 13.7% dividend hike to $1.16.
Yeah. Oh, Costco is still at 0.6% forward yield. But didn't they have this $15 special dividend the other day? So if you count that special dividend, it's a lot. But I look, 68th dividend hike from Procter & Gamble, and I put it on social media, on Twitter, like something like, yeah, Unilever, I'm watching at you. Yeah. Come on, guys. Come on, Unilever. Yeah. Come on. Yeah. But yeah, that's just it. Come on,
Like we talked about Shell. We talked about Shell jumping ship over to the U.S. It would probably make more sense for Unilever to do that, considering where they're trading at. They might get some reaction out of their share price and save the CEO some years of hard work.
Yeah, true. I mean, look, congrats to all the Procter & Gamble shareholders. I mean, it's iconic, 68 consecutive dividend hikes. I mean, that shows the power of this company. I mean, and I can only have appreciation for it.
134 consecutive years of actually paying a dividend as well.
Yeah, okay, but General Electric will say the same. Yeah, that tells me nothing. Yeah, General Electric, I think they hiked the dividend as well quite significantly now, 260% or something like that. But still, it's still like 10% of what it was. I mean, I'm doing this from my head. I don't know exactly. I may be totally wrong, but 10% for what it was before the cut in 2016, something like that. So, I mean, nice for the statistics. don't you remember Bayer as well? They still pay 11 cents or something like that because they are legally obliged. I mean, this company is going into the places where the sun doesn't shine. Yeah, and they will then later in 15 years from now say we paid 100 consecutive dividends. It means nothing, Derek. It means nothing.
Bayer are in trouble, aren't they? I saw something briefly that they're asking their employees, 10,000 employees, to be more cost efficient, is it?
Yeah, 100,000. And they have a 1,300, it was like the CEO or something like that, or someone was quoted saying like, yeah, they have their management book of 1,300 pages, and it's even longer than the book War and Peace. And they want to reduce it by 99%. I mean, this is going to be I can't imagine how this is going to work in such culture. Talk about doing a 180 degree flip, right? This is unheard of. Going from total top down decision making, red tape, and then suddenly to these employees must be lost.
Yeah, it's in trouble. It's in big trouble, and you wonder if it'll go private at some stage. It's in that much trouble.
Or just being acquired, and then make a deal. I mean, it's a sad thing, Bayer. We talk about patriotic, right, and a European powerhouse. This is, if we talk so often about, but this must be the worst acquisition in European history.
You think about it, has so much potential. It's just that one product, Monsanto, that one Roundup.
Yeah, but also just mismanagement, continuous mismanagement. Yeah. And the new CEO is trying, but I find it very, very risky to put such a big reorganization, effectively cultural change in. Like, it's not like it is like a small change, like incremental. This is like, I hope it won't be a dead cat bounce.
Time will tell. Anyway, onto our main topic. And this was actually inspired, I imagine, by one of the questions on Facebook that we got around investing in what would we do if there was a global war between Israel and Iran and the stock market dropped 20% Monday morning.
Yeah, this from Marta, and we got a few questions still related to this, I believe, right? Because first of all, it is very sad what's happening now in this war between Israel and Iran. I mean, we don't do politics on the podcast, but I just hope that nobody gets hurt by this from our listeners and such. It's just a sad thing, right? So, you know, if you take this into consideration of what happened last night, and then of course the whole lead up to this and then what happened in October last year, but then also together with this, there was fresh US import data on Friday. So generally speaking, people are scared about the higher inflation to be sustained, no rate cuts. So what happened on Friday, the market went 1.5% down, actually 1.5% down for the entire week. If you zoom out on the year, it's still like near all-time high. So just to mention, but a lot of stocks went into sale that were already in decline. And that's interesting, right? You had the Magnificent Seven. I think this is reference to those tech stocks. Yeah. But you have a few companies like Hershey and such, and United Health, UPS, that have been in already a few weeks in a downtrend, and they are becoming for many investors now very attractive. I see that on social media. Take on top then this unrest where people sometimes are saying, will this be a third world war now starting and such? So I thought like, okay, I see the stress level coming up at the moment. So maybe this is this moment in time, and we've done it in the past. Often when there is something, we have a topic like this, like, okay, how do we deal with this, stress, right? Because it's not easy investing during times of a market crash, for instance. I have no clue if there will come something, but if the fear is high, it requires a lot of mental resilience from the investor, keeping your head cool. So maybe from that point of view, right, we don't need to go further into the what's happening in the world, but just generally speaking, like, you know, you live for the first time really through a crash during COVID, right? What is your biggest takeaway from that time, if you think about it? What from your learnings, like what do you feel like you did bad and you wouldn't do again, and what do you feel you did really well at the time?
Yeah, do you know what, I was thinking about this recently, even before we had this podcast, and one of the biggest things that I found was it was really like a candy store, and I felt like I was just buying everything, no bits of everything, and in the end I'm restructuring my portfolio, and there's a lot of stuff that I'm taking out of it as a result of that time, but there was a lot of stuff on sale, and I wish at the time I focused more on my like it sounds corny, but my higher conviction companies, my higher conviction stocks, because I was buying companies that I no longer have. I'd say Comcast is one of them off the top of my head. There are others, but I didn't really have a plan. It was just like, oh, this is on sale, and I logged in on that day and bought this one. Now, I did have a lot of cash on the side, luckily, and I was able to buy a lot of stocks, but what I did really poorly is not have a plan, and probably like a little bit more like impulse buying, if you get me. I was just buying what was shiny and on sale on that day, rather than sticking with my own plan. I think that's okay. my key takeaway.
But we are 4 years later now. Do you have a plan?
Yeah, I think my portfolio is definitely taking a little bit more shape. So I would definitely focus on a lot more of my higher conviction companies. You know, I'm big into REITs at the moment, so I'm happy with that, particularly with the news with the CPI. They're not going to reduce interest rates. And I honestly believe that BG and Agree Realty are able to contain in this environment for 2 or 3 years, no issues. So for me, it's an opportunity to buy those types of companies. Whereas before, if I had seen this, I would have been buying every single real estate that I could think of.
So do you have a list then now? Is there like, let's say, a list of 10 stocks that you feel like, okay, if a crash comes, those 10 are the cornerstones of my portfolio? And for instance, you say Vici, but I know you have quite some Vici, but are there also those stocks that you feel like, okay, they were always too expensive, but definitely if the time comes, I will be bouncing the table for those 5-6 stocks, let's say, out of the 10.
There's definitely some, like Siemens comes to my mind as a European perspective. Yeah. I really want to own more Siemens.
Schneider,
Microsoft is up there as well. So those types of companies. I'm on the fence with Johnson & Johnson. Honestly, I'm not as bullish as I used to be on those, but I would.
Why is that? What changed?
They've changed their company. They are now medtech, basically. They are medtech. So I don't think it is as stable. So you really have to rely on understanding their pipeline a lot more, which is quite difficult if you're not a scientist. Let's be honest. You're relying a lot on what scientists are saying.
But MedTech, we're talking about the products here, right? And because when you say pipeline, you refer more to the pharma component.
Pharma is the biggest part of their business at the moment, which I struggle to understand fully. And then I think they're relying a lot on acquisitions lately to try and bluster up because they have this patent cliff coming up. So for me, I need to do a little bit more digging, a little bit more understanding.
But it's AAA balance sheet.
Course, but that can change. I mean, that can change, and you know, I need to understand, can they keep that? What will change that AAA balance sheet? Mm-hmm. What will deteriorate that balance sheet? So that would be my main reason.
I get it. Yeah. Okay, so you have your list prepared, I guess, then. So you have a list that you will be buying, but how do you deal with the fact that you know you mentioned this so often already in the past, like this kind of speculation sense. So what system do you have in place now to avoid again just buying everything that comes your path? How do you know that you will stick to your list? That's easier said than done.
Of course, you never know, but I think with everything, experience comes into it. Unless you I always find, in everything I've ever done, I've always learned the hard way. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is that you learn from it. So I do know that I've bought a lot of stuff, and I had to take a lot of time to kind of filter out my portfolio and try and get it into a position that I'm kind of happy with. So I know what that's like. I know what that feels like. So I'll take that. Will I probably buy one or two spontaneously? Probably, maybe. There's a high percentage given my personality traits, but I definitely feel like I'm definitely a little bit more disciplined. I took that approach away from options. I haven't touched them. I went anywhere next to near them in over 18 months now. So it's just a learning process, and you build on that experience that you learn over time. I mean, if you don't make mistakes, you'll never learn. And it's the one thing I teach my kids is it's okay to make mistakes, but it's not okay to make the same mistake over and over, because then it's not a mistake. Yeah.
And as long as it's not a big mistake, right?
yeah. Life-changing mistake.
Yeah. And Kieran Ainsley asked, like, and then this is a bit related to that. So when deals start to present in the market as they currently are, do you find extra sources of money to invest? If so, from where? Yeah. So he's, for instance, thinking moving some money from his emergency funds, still leaving a comfortable amount there. So generally, do you have extra cash to deploy during a crash? Do you have something like a war chest?
I did during COVID, but not so much now. I'm pretty much fully invested now, and then whatever money I have outside is earmarked for other things. So I don't have that. Would I dip into my emergency fund during a crisis? Probably not, because during a crisis is probably when you need that emergency fund, in my opinion. And I'm thinking about the topic and the question that we spoke about at the start, which was, what would we do if there was a global war and it dropped 20% in the morning? And honestly, if there was a global war, depending on the type of crash, but if we're specifically talking about a war here, a global war, I would not be thinking about investing. I'd be more trying to preserve my safety. Can I access cash easily? What if I need to move? So I wouldn't be.
You'd be standing in the line in the supermarket buying toilet paper.
Yeah, if I need to, or milk. But for me, during a crisis, it depends on the type of crisis. Obviously, during COVID, it was a little bit different because we were in lockdown. I was earning the same, if not more, money from my workplace, but I couldn't spend it. So I had that safety blanket. But I think during something like a global war, it might be a little bit different.
Yeah.
What do you think? What would you do?
Well, I'm like you. I'm mostly fully invested. It depends on the type of crisis. I mean, when we had COVID, I knew that my job was safe. Yeah, I could work from remote, so I saw no issue there. Like you, if there's a war, I have other things on my mind. This is also the reason why I don't want everything invested in real estate. I mean, on the East, what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, if the spoils over, at least I have some money virtual, in the international stock market at a foreign broker, which gives me a sense of safety. So that's kind of, because otherwise I've got, if they blow up the house, then everything is gone. Yeah. So, but I would, I think I could find some money. There are still some savings here and there that are maybe not perfectly allocated. Maybe some from my wife's savings or something like that, where we say like, okay, maybe bring it forward. But then it would be like, okay, then we fill it up again in the next few months. Yeah. So it wouldn't be emergency fund. It would be more like savings that we have, I don't know, for a car repairment. Okay, for a new car. Okay, you know what? Then let's postpone the car. We refill it over the next half year, but let's make use of this opportunity right now. Yeah. That's probably how it would be more. But I wouldn't touch my emergency fund, because that would be for if one of us would be jobless, or both us would be jobless, and that we don't need to sell the house or anything, right? That we can still buy food. So
yeah, and that's where the type of crisis comes in, because not every crisis is the same. And if job security is not there, I would not want to be moving money around and put more money into investments.
But you could also argue that at that time maybe you need to sell some shares then, if it really happens. Yeah, in the worst case. So there's also again a question, right? If you buy at that bottom, you could also sell at the a bottom to. In the end, it's emergency money then. So there's also this concept, right, that people say like, I don't need an emergency fund because the stock market goes to zero, then the world is at its end. So if this happens, then I just sell a few shares, and to sustain my life. There's also a way of looking at it. I mean, if you're already at that stage that you're like me, for instance, it's 60% expense coverage. I could always sell a few Microsoft shares to pay for some bills.
Yeah.
Not that I want to, but if you think about long term, having your whole emergency fund deployed in the stock market, it may have generated and compensated already for that. But look, it's not something that I advise, but I know this is also a school of thought that some people have. I just want hard cash for when it matters. I don't have gold, by the way. I've thought about that sometimes. Should I just have a few gold bars? But I never did this.
Yeah. And then if you look at through COVID, how did you cipher through companies that were short-term impacted? Maybe their dividend was frozen or stopped or whatever. How did you cipher out which ones would recover or which ones were short-term?
So, I said that was hard to say because COVID happened in March and dividends were just announced for most of the European companies and they got cut later at the annual general meeting, yeah, or they were postponed. So, you didn't have that information at that time for most of the companies. For me, it was really simple. I was already investing for 5-6 years. I knew what my company, what my ideal portfolio composition looked like. I had already my anchor stocks, so I knew what to buy. Yeah, like Chubb. Because Chubb I bought, I think, in June because the insurance companies were late with the crash. I think they were still figuring out that they have an impact or not. But now I was able to buy straight away those companies that I wanted, like Johnson & Johnson, I believe, at $115 at the time, something like that. So I felt very confident. And it was the first time that I felt so confident. Also with Shell, yeah, we've spoken about a few times on the podcast, Shell going down and cutting the dividend. And I still felt really confident about buying Shell and increasing my position significantly. I don't know what it was exactly. I think it was just an accumulation of a few years doing my homework, having a bit of structure in place, knowing where I want to build my portfolio. And I just felt like this clarity at that time in my mind, yeah? The clarity in the storm, it was really interesting. Like, I was at the eye of a tornado and I just saw the cows flying about me, around me, chaos, and I felt like, no, I'm buying. Yeah.
Because it was a strange...
And all those investments did well for me, by the way.
Yeah, and in hindsight, you could have probably hit a stock with a dart and it would have done well because a lot of stuff jumped
down.
Well,
not if you were in the blast zone. Yeah, if you were with the cruise lines and everything, there was a blast zone. So my advice from what I learned, stay out of the blast zone. If, like in 2008... banks were down. Yeah, it pulled the housing market down, but also consumer staples. You bought the consumer staples, but don't buy banks at that time. During COVID, don't buy restaurants and how is it? And that can't how is it? Like McDonald's could do how is it delivery, but don't buy those that are subject to physical presence, like the airlines, cruise lines. Yeah, if you are interested in dividend growth, if you feel like, planes come back, okay, buy the airlines, but then you're like, again, value investing, not dividend growth investing. But stay away from the blast zone. That's always my recommendation because you don't know how bad those companies are at that time. But buy those that are effectively not in the blast zone, but are pulled with it because people are massively dumping their ETFs and everything, right? Where also the good stocks are part of.
Yeah, I think that's the key to figuring out: is it short term impacted or is it long term? I mean, if they're in the blast zone, you don't know if it will be long term or not. I think if you mentioned cruise liners, and I think CCL Cruise. Mm-hmm. They were trading at around $30. I don't know if they're anywhere near that, next to near that. They dropped the single dollars.
Yeah.
They had to take on a ton of debt just to keep themselves afloat. I do know numbers are up, but they still have to recover from that debt load that they put on themselves. So it might take some time. So I think that's probably really good advice to stay away from the blast zone. But it's hard. It's not hard, but it's tempting for those, like we looked at the medical company earlier on. You see deep value in your mind, you think it's so cheap because they were trading at 30, they are now 10, and it's easy to fall into that trap. And I suppose that's
For instance, Johnson & Johnson was a good example at that time because you could argue like, okay, how are patients getting their drugs during COVID? Yeah, but then you read in the news that those patients, like cancer patients, and still were treated. Of course, it was much harder to treat at the time. But you know, like, okay, you know, AAA balance sheet, they will do well over time. So it was really easy, but of course, was a bit impacted. There were other companies that were still impacted because of that, but maybe they had like 10 or 15% less EPS or something like that, yeah? So, but then Johnson & Johnson also with the baby shampoo and everything that they had, come on, you know? Yeah, so it was for me really easy to buy. So it doesn't mean like that a company is not affected by the crisis, but being affected and being in the blast zone for me is two different things. Like those those companies, they're really part of the news cycle, like Burns and Stearns, you know, Freddie Mae and Fannie Mac, who actually invented the names. Yeah, it's almost like too good to be true for a movie. But yeah, you know, that's why you stay away. Yeah. But yeah. This is my opinion, yeah, and I look at it from a, listeners should not be mistaken, I look at it from a dividend growth point of view, so risk of dividend cut. Because from the other side, you could say like, yeah, if you're in the middle of the blast zone and you know when the bottom is, you can make a gazillion of money, of course, right, but yeah. From the rebounds, but that's not my style of investing, I'm not good enough.
Yeah,
of course, my circle of competence. Yeah.
You can hold close to the bottom and double your money once there is a bounce.
I mean, if you bought ING at €2 at the time, or €2.50, then you know you tripled or quadrupled your money.
But I think you have to have an honest conversation with yourself about what your strategy is as an investor.
Exactly.
And I think that's the trap it's easy to fall into, and I find, like, you know, myself, that I would easily fall into that trap. So you have to be honest with yourself. You have to hold yourself accountable. And if that's what you want to do, fine. But you have to be honest with yourself and say, I'm speculating here.
But how do you hold yourself accountable?
When you lose a shit ton of money.
Then what do? You look in the mirror and you say, I'm an accountable person.
You look in the mirror and say, okay, I lost this money because of me. Okay.
I'm a loser.
Yeah. You see, it is a tough one, because if you do buy it at the bottom and you get lucky and it rises 100%, but then you're going to feel like that you're the greatest investor of all time. Yeah. But really, if you buy it and it drops.
So tell me, okay, let's say like that, you're not in the blast zone, but just generally. I mean, the PE multiple of the S&P 500 stays historically high. Yeah. Let's assume it goes back to the mean of a multiple 15. Let's assume that with that, the stock market crashes almost by 50%. I mean, what is your risk tolerance? Would you be fine if your portfolio crashes with 50% and let's say a few dividend cuts here and there?
Would I be fine? That's a good question. It's easy to say yes, but I think when you're looking at those red numbers of 50%, it is hard. You know, my goal is to get to 100K this year. And if I'm now looking at a 50K portfolio, that would definitely emotionally hurt. It would be hard to take. Yeah. Am I prepared? So I try and look at it from two things. I always tell my wife, okay, the money that we invest, it's invested, it's gone, it's not there. Look at it, but do not count it as part of our everyday expenses and stuff. So if it does go to zero, the worst case happens, our life is not affected and how we live at this moment. So our lifestyle doesn't change. So I think I'd have to try and reinforce that into my brain if I saw a 50% drop. But honestly, I don't think many people, especially I would class myself as middle class with close enough to 100K invested, would be able to say to take 50% of that and not bat an eyelid.
But it's, the scenario is not unlikely that I just mentioned, right?
No, it's not unlikely.
Okay, so why are you then not investing in bonds, for instance?
It's a good question, but
because bonds are yielding now as well, pretty nice.
Yeah, they are now.
You have some value protection with that,
but they're not 100% safe either.
Nothing is 100% safe.
But
generally speaking, you could argue that you get your principal back, right? If you invest in bonds, so it's more like a question of the yield, and unless America would go bankrupt or your European country that you're investing in. So, yeah, your principal is protected with that. So why not then now going into, I don't know, 30% bonds of your portfolio?
It could potentially make sense and probably ease out some of the risk tolerance that you have. again, you have to think of my circle of competence, and at the moment, they're not it. So I'd have to go and really learn them. I don't want to just jump into bonds because they're yielding high and because theory says that they are safe. So I'd have to go and really understand that.
Yeah.
At the time, bonds were not an option because the yields were poor.
I think preparation you need to do before a crisis hits. Those boring months that we had in the past was perfect time to do your prep. Yeah, to think about your portfolio composition, which are the stocks that you really have strong conviction of. If tomorrow the stock market opens and shit hits the fan, then for me, it will be too late because the news cycle will not be... the news cycle will be like so stressed that it's really hard to keep your head cool. So you need to do that prep before it. Yeah, and I can tell you why I'm not in bonds here. I believe that 70-80% of my portfolio are really, really strong businesses, and I believe in them. If my portfolio will go down, I believe that all those companies will still pay a dividend, like where they were, and a growing dividend, maybe not growing so fast anymore because maybe the consumer is weaker or something like that, and they will be a bit more conservative. But I feel that my income is protected. I may maybe get a haircut in dividends to the value of 10% of my PADI, my projected annual dividend income. Maybe that, Derek. So I really am not attached to the value in there. And I would actually be very happy because I would see it as a time that I can reinvest those dividends at much better yields. Yeah, my portfolio, if it would go in half, it would shoot up from almost 4% to 8% yield. Probably that would mean that also the interest rates are around 8 and 9% in America at that time. And then the question is, will it be sustained longer? But with almost no debt in my household, this would be a great time, Derek. It would be awesome. Yeah, and then I will probably have to tell my wife, like, yeah, you know, that's you know, we have been investing 10 years and there's quite some capital loss, but going forward, we will be much quicker to financial independence with the cash flow from my work that's coming in. And I'm saying that it's easy saying this up front. Yeah, I understand that. But I've been preparing... Now I said not preparing, but I've been running these scenarios so often in my mind that I feel cool. Because I've asked myself many times this question, I've been always asking me, therefore, should I go then in bonds or not to protect my principal? Now, when would I go in bonds? I think if I am financially independent and if I really can't risk losing the money anymore. So I imagine maybe that, let's say in a few years from now, let's say 3-4 years, I will be hitting the 100%. I will probably still have income. I'm still on the young end from that point of view. But let's say I reach 70, my income kept on growing. It's double of it. I only need half to sustain life. I will probably shift, 40% or 50% to bonds just to make sure that my kids can inherit the value of the money or something like that. That's my thinking now. So I wouldn't say that I would never do bonds, but at this moment in time of life, I feel very comfortable with the risk. But I think when you're coming near to your stairway to heaven, let's say, I think it's not anymore for me and my wife. It will be for the kids. And then I think capital protection becomes a little bit more important. That's my feeling.
Yeah. I mean, I believe you when you say that you'd be cool, calm, and collected if it dropped 50%. Knowing you for as long as I do, I can completely see that. But then, how would your wife feel about that? Let's just say one or both of your jobs are at risk.
Wouldn't care. I know my wife. She wouldn't care. She would maybe ask, like, are we in trouble? I would say no. And then, okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because honestly, I speak a lot about money. I talk a lot about money, but we don't need money to be happy.
No.
It's really awkward, yeah? So I need money to buy time. That's what it is. But it isn't about happiness. And those are still two different things.
Yeah, that I completely agree with, because I think my wife would have that mindset of, we don't need money to be happy whatsoever. And yeah. She would not bat an eyelid if I told her that my portfolio dropped 90%.
Yeah.
She would say that's okay. That's yours. But I mean, when you're in times of crisis, it's one thing you saying that you'll be okay with it, yeah. But this is a partnership and it would be hard if one person is.
Yeah, panicking. But I would say the income is still there, you know.
Interesting. So what about cyclical stocks then? How do you handle those types of companies? Because you mentioned.
Yeah, I try to generally a bit avoid them during those moments. First of all, they are a bit harder to grasp. We know that. We know that you need to buy Shell when the oil price is at $30. Yeah, that's when you buy it, let's say. But I try to avoid them because for me, then is the time to buy quality. Yeah, it doesn't mean the cyclical stocks are not quality, but what I mean is like those stocks that I usually can't buy because they always feel expensive. So I tend to avoid cyclical stocks. In my opinion, Shell was just an exception at the time because oil crashed because of COVID and no planes in the air. The oil price went to zero. I mean, that was an exception. But like in the normal circumstances, of course, a normal crisis doesn't exist. I would rather focus on those consumer staples and those high conviction, always expensive stocks. And then, by the way, what usually when, let's say, the market would crash 50% or 20%, your Johnson & Johnson doesn't drop 50 or 20%. If the market goes down 20%, your Johnson does maybe 5 or 6%. But this 5 or 6% may be just enough to have a decent yield on cost.
Yeah. It's all crisis dependent. As we said, it depends on the type of crisis.
Yeah, because if my portfolio will go down 50%, then probably the overall stock market went down 70 or 80%. Yeah, because of the defensive nature of my portfolio.
Yeah, which makes sense. As dividend growth investors, we miss out on that growth that all our growth friends tell us about. But
yeah.
we have some downside protection. So yeah. you take the good with the bad.
Yeah, true, true, true. Good. Hey, so I hope this was interesting for the listeners, how we think about it today. I guess it's all about like guys, you know, we don't know what will happen going forward. Yeah, I expect actually, I hope, let's say, that these things don't escalate and that the stock market continues to do what it's been doing for the last few years, onwards and upwards. If you get a little dip, then yeah, act wisely. I assume there's still time to do your homework. So if you ask yourself now, like, I'm actually not prepared for a crisis, sit down, you know, take yourself, go sit at the kitchen table when the kids are to bed or something like that. Look at your portfolio, list those 10 stocks that you always wanted to have but could never buy, nice dividend growth stocks, and mark them, print it out, put it on the wall beside the place where you're always hitting the buy button for stocks. Put it in frame, whatever, and remember to look at it when the stock markets are down, when there's chaos in the streets. That's when you buy those jewels. Yeah. Only those, of course, that are not in the blast zone.
Exactly. So we might move on to a portfolio review. Actually, we haven't done this in quite a while. And dividend.
The Div Collector, he reached out to me today saying like, guys, can you do my portfolio? And of course, you know, we love those things. It's just like, well, we actually didn't pay a lot of attention to it later, but we should. So I shared the screenshot of his portfolio with you. What are your first thoughts? Maybe if you can explain how the portfolio also looks like.
I'll list out some of the top 10 stocks. So we've got NN Group. We've got Ahold Delhaize, top two positions. Agree Realty is third. Then you got Realty Income, RTX, British American Tobacco, Microsoft, ASML, Johnson & Johnson, and T. Rowe Price. And the highest position in that is NN Group at 11%, but then it tapers down. And you would say his top three positions is roughly 25% of the portfolio. So that's NN Group, Agree Realty, and Ahold Delhaize. And then after that, I think it's nicely diversified. So a little bit top heavy in the top three, but after that, it's spread out quite evenly. When we spoke a little bit off air when I was looking at it first, and it does seem really nicely diversified in terms of you've got high yield. And I think high yielding is probably a sign of the times because they are more at the top end of the portfolio. So you've got high yielding, you've got some actually dividend darlings like Johnson & Johnson, ASML, you've got some growth components in there, you've got Microsoft, and you've got Starbucks in there as well. I think it's a nice mix geographically and the components within it. I think it's very, and when I look at the top 10, it's not too dissimilar from mine. There's one or two differences. RTX is not in my portfolio, but it has a similar makeup to my own portfolio.
I must say, I really like his portfolio. I think it's really well composed. I think what I can see has been a relatively new investor probably here. If you have NN Group, also Agree Realty, Realty Income and such in the top, then we know that this is a sign of last year, right?
Yeah.
So what he also says, and I think that's also good to say, he has a great lesson that he learned since he started his portfolio, because he bought a ton of Shell at 10 euro and then dumped it around 24 euros due to the imbalance in his portfolio. And he says now, like, I really need to let my winners run. It's not nice. Although he feels like his portfolio balance doesn't feel good yet, but it's not yet the time to have a really well-balanced portfolio. And I can so much underline this, because if you know what your target portfolio kind of should look like in value of dividend income and portfolio value, and you're in the accumulation phase, specifically in the first few years of the accumulation phase, yeah, then you just know that you will be imbalanced almost by definition if you take the opportunities that the sectors provide. And I had to go through the similar learning. I sold McDonald's at 120, thinking it was overvalued. Yeah, so you know these things happen. But I think it's good to have those learnings. Better late than never. Yeah. But I really like his portfolio. Like you say, it's a mix of consumer staples, real estate investment trust. He is also having a play with RTX and Harris, L3 Harris or something like that, on the defense industry. Was a topic we paid quite some attention to in our latest newsletter, right? Yep. Also with the deep dive on BAA systems from the UK. But then he has Starbucks in there, Johnson & Johnson, ASML, Microsoft. So strong portfolio, I would say. Like, there's really nothing here for me to say do different. To his point, you know, he's in the accumulation phase. It's like 20 stocks or so. So it will actually more, I think. What is it? Not 20, but 30 maybe. Okay, 30 stocks. But I would just say, like, continue on this path. And don't be afraid to share your listing on Twitter or on Facebook in our Facebook group, because I think it would be very interesting for others to see how it's composed.
Yeah, I mean, he does mention that the portfolio balance does not feel good yet. And I disagree with that. I actually think it's nicely balanced. I understand you have NN Group at the top at 11%, but I think your top eight, your top nine companies is roughly 50% of your portfolio. And that's the way, in my opinion, it should be. Because those, I'm guessing, are your highest conviction. And if they are not your highest conviction, means you're taking on too much risk in that one particular company. So maybe look at that. But in terms of diversification and balance, we all read the same books. We all make the same mistakes because we read the same books. I think we all take it a little too literal at times. You don't need to be perfectly balanced the whole way through your investment journey. If you have conviction in a company, by all means, be a little bit overweight because your bank balance might thank you later.
Well, what I think for people is good to understand is risk is volatility. Volatility is risk in financial terms. So if if you can just look at the beta of stocks, if, for instance, NN Group would have a very high beta, like 2 or something like that, yeah, you probably have a lot of risk in here, right? But many of these are low beta stocks as well. So I really, to your point. It is about his conviction. So Div Collector, ask yourself, like Derek said, how is your conviction for the top 10? So are you convicted? Do you have a lot of conviction for NN Group, Ahold Delhaize, Agree Realty, Realty Income, RTX, British American Tobacco, Microsoft, ASML, Johnson & Johnson, T. Rowe Price, because that's your top 10. If you have your conviction there, then pretty well done.
Nice portfolio, though, I must say.
Yeah.
So we'll continue on with some questions. And M.M. Markovic has asked us about Zoetis, ticker symbol ZTS. They've been in the news recently because the share price has dropped. I can't remember the reason why, but they popped up now, basically. Are they deep value? Look, I think I said this last week. We were asked about them. I think they are a fantastic company. They were spun off by Pfizer. They're in the companion market. So anyone who loves cats and dogs would love this company because they provide the healthcare to keep them safe and better and all that good stuff. And there's honestly, there's big marketing. I can't believe the amount of money people spend on their companions or pets, as they're called. But look, they are fantastically managed. For me, the yield is too low. I think they're still sub 1%. Maybe it's with the price drop, it might be teetering around 1%. The growth rate is quite high. I think it's around 15-16%, which typically you see with good companies like this. Look, if it gets closer to $100, I'll definitely buying this company. I have to say, I think it's fantastic. But oil yields at 1%, it's a no go for me. But yeah, it's a good company, I have to say.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that, right? I often say this, like 1 year, 1%, 15% growth, but for how long, right? And today there was on Facebook group, Many Mystery also made a really nice comment, like, sometimes we focus too much on dividend growth, because if you have a company that maintains a high yield, right, the dividend, they say 10%, but each, like, it's every year 10%, you reinvest the dividends, you know, your share count will grow and your overall dividend income will also really go up. And I think this is inspired by the income factory and really resonated with me a lot as well. So this yield topic is always very interesting, but for that reason for those reasons, I tend to appreciate the higher yield a little bit more. And I'm looking for at least 2.75% as well, because I don't want to wait 30, 40 years before financially independent, and I'm not doing it for the capital appreciation. And, yes. And really, I can't predict a company to have 20 years, 15% growth coming ahead. So I understand I'm more of unique with this view, because many people like to have a combination of growth and dividend growth, let's say. I get that. But I'm very particular. I wanna be financially independent as fast as possible. And then after that, maybe I start tinkering with the low yielders or some increasing my growth section of the portfolio. But first, I wanna get to get my time back.
Yeah, look, I think if you're taking on this type of company that's 1% or like Visa or like MasterCard, those type of companies, it's not about the dividend. You're probably more concerned about the price. Price appreciation, yeah. And the dividend is a bonus on that, something you don't expect. That, in my opinion, that's what those companies would be to me. They would not be forming a core of my dividend growth portfolio. It could be a part of a dividend portfolio, but
yeah, what I do sometimes with LVMH or something like that, right? As such, but what I then like to do often is like combine it with a higher yielder. Yeah, so take an N Group at 7%, buy the stock for 1%. You have on average, 3.5-4% then still.
Yeah, I like to combine higher yield with high yield as well.
Oh, the listeners can't see your face, but how you expressed it was like clear. It was really nice.
Abraham has asked us, is there any possibility me and you, so European DGI and Derek, could become fund managers and co-manage a mutual fund in the future?
No.
What would you think?
No. We have our newsletter and such, and we are trying to really, give this European view on dividend safety. That's really our mission, right? We really want to, be able to say, like, all these European stocks, what the dividend safety ratings are, so that, because we as Europeans, we have a currency risk, and we don't often want to have all the money in a dollar portfolio. So that's really where we are on a mission, also with the newsletter, making it easier for people. But going into fund management, I think it would make me too stressed, because I take everyone serious, also my listeners. The time I spent on answering questions and everything as well, the emails that we get and such, right? I do this with passion. But if I think about that someone has been investing their hard-earned money in the fund and the fund would underperform or something like that and it wouldn't make them their dreams, I would feel bad about that. It would go into my bones emotionally. I think I can't pull that.
I'd wonder how our strategy would change if we did own a fund, or would it change? Because like you said, you're now not only thinking about yourself, you have many other people's money that you're accountable for.
Yeah. I would probably be much more taking on less risk.
A lot more conservative, which probably means you're not going to beat the market.
Yeah, but okay. But I wouldn't accept money from people that expect us beating the market because we're in for dividend growth. What I would look for more is then a systematic approach as Schwab dividend growth. Yeah, but then that works for Europeans. Yeah, that's what I would be looking at and doing more rule-based to take the emotion out. Also to make it clear more to the people that it's not that we wouldn't be doing such a fund as stock pickers. We would do it rule-based. Yeah, also to have those discussions parked. Yeah, no, but when I think about all of this, no, I would never see myself doing this. Never say never, they say, but no, it's not on my... It's not in my thinking at all.
M. Mac has asked us about Starbucks. They have negative equity. What's your take on this?
So the negative equity, you know, that's just a result of the buybacks in the past. It also means that the assets are owned by debt. And if you would sell all the assets, you would still need to find the debt somewhere. Yeah. So... That is an issue. So effectively, how you need to look at Starbucks, like they borrowed money to buy back shares, and borrowed it from the future, assuming that the company is growing and that the free cash flow will growing, and that one day the equity would come up again. That's it. And the question therefore is like, do you believe that the free cash flow will grow over the 10 years? Next 10 years, let's say, that they the shares that they bought then at the time would be, of course, at a good price, because the share price in the future should be higher then, and that they will stop doing buybacks, let the retained earnings from the net income come into the balance sheet so that the equity go up. Do you think that this will happen, let's say, in the next 10, 20 years? Will the free cash flow grow, and will they have better financial discipline than in the past because they've borrowed from the future? That's really the question. And I think every question should ask that for themselves, because then it comes to like trusting the CFO, the CEO, thinking about the business model. So what we often say, right? We teach a man to fish; we don't give them a fish. Yeah.
No, it's a good question, on it. It's good to look at that and understand why they've done it, but then ask yourself the question: Are you comfortable with that?
Yes, and I think I've done, because we also have as part of our membership, we also have a course, right? How to read the three financial statements, and I think I have pulled up the Starbucks balance sheet, I think, for that reason to show this.
Morpheus has asked us about Greggs. They are a British bakery chain. What do you think of them as a dividend growth stock?
First of all, I never heard of them. So I went to Investor Relations website and I started laughing, and you didn't understand why, because I said I had to accept all cookies. And you said like, oh, you have to do that with every website. I said, but I have to accept cookies here. Yeah, like literally it's a bakery, and you see a picture from someone in corporate governance or something like that eating a cookie. So I found it so special. So I hope, Greggs, if someone who works there is listening, please contact me. I accepted the cookies. I expect a nice box coming to my home address. Yeah, I accepted them. But honestly, this one is very interesting, you know. 2013, if I understand it well, they initiated the dividend for around 18 or 19 pence. It's now at 59 pence per year, so it kind of tripled. It didn't pay a dividend in 2020. We spoke about that earlier, but it compensated almost all of it in 2021. So I don't want to be too strict on those companies, specifically that this was a company in the blast zone, because they depend on physical store visits. So probably I didn't analyze it. Probably they were able to shift a bit to delivery, but... Let's give them a little bit of a one-eye close there. But other than that, very solid. very solid. So at least I like from what I see at the surface. Yeah. Also, their EPS has been growing from 30 pence to 118 right now. So it quadrupled at the same time. So no, this is pretty okay. Also, the return on capital employed, what we look at, 21%, 23%. So always in the 20s, almost the 30s sometimes. They have been growing also the store count from 1,670 to 2,328 now. So this one has my attention, my friend.
Yeah, I'm really familiar with Greggs as a chain. Not so much as a dividend growth stock. I didn't know they were a dividend growth stock.
What do you think about the chain? Do they sell nice bread? Is it worth it?
So what they sell is pastries and so if you want hot dogs or pies and kind of hot food, they also have deli's and that kind of food. But what really makes them stick out is that they're cheap and they're a go-to that, I mean, if you're in a downturn and you still want to go and treat yourself, you go to Greggs. And actually,
a low cost option, like McDonald's. Yeah, you don't want to go for an expensive meal. You're on a budget. You go to McDonald's.
Exactly. So when I go over a group of male friends, and we go, and our main objective is to go and probably go to watch the horse race, and then we go drinking. It's usually Greggs, Witherspoon's, McDonald's are the three that you go to, and they would be in that chain. The pastries are really, actually, really nice. And every time I go over, we go to a football match. We usually go down to Greggs on a Saturday morning for a breakfast, and then off we go to a football match. But look, I think they have huge potential. It has a really good name. Everyone I know in the UK loves Greggs. They actually tried to open a chain up here in Dublin, I believe, and it wasn't as successful as it was in the UK. I think it's more tailored to the UK market, which is a little bit concerning. But I do know they are trying to really push that store count. I think you mentioned 2,000. I read somewhere only recently, you know, I think it was in the Irish Times, that they're trying to push that beyond 3,000, which is not beyond the possibility for them. So
yeah,
I think it is look really interesting. I'd be curious about the margins. As we said, it is low cost. It is known as the kind of Lidl and Aldi kind of area in terms of cost. So I'd wonder what their margins are like. I don't know. In terms of a business, in terms of popularity, a brand, it's really strong over in the UK, and it would be an interesting company to look at.
Well, thanks for bringing it to our attention. I would say something for on the have a bit of a deeper look list, right?
Yeah, so. Of course. Well, I'll do that while I'm in the UK and having a.
Oh, you're going for a stock safari.
Bean and sausage pie.
Well, hey, while you're in the UK, then go to to Starbucks or something like that, and let us also know, right? Or Costa Coffee for Coca-Cola. And because Dakota Fred is asking us, actually, what are your thoughts on Hershey, Nike, and Vichy? And I believe you own Vichy. Are you doing anything with Vichy at the time?
I like Vichy. I think they're constantly undervalued or close to fair value, I would say, in terms of their net asset value. Obviously, once interest rates are as high as they are, and with no real outlook of them coming down, I think they'll remain at that price. But we got to remember, these were one of the only real estates that had 100% occupancy rate during COVID. It's probably got a really, really strong business model. I don't see Las Vegas going out of business. So
anything that's addictive, it's worth like owning it sometimes, right?
Yeah. I mean, looking at the list of Dakota there, Nike is probably, look, Nike is a quality business, but it's probably the one that I would see the most risk in there.
We spoke about it last week, right?
Yeah, we did. So I think Hershey is a solid business. Nike is a solid business, and also Vichy. So I think that there are some good opportunities. Hershey is one that's probably I want to look at a little bit deeper. I don't have the same conviction as you do. You've done your analysis on them. I haven't. They come up quite a bit. Actually, I think you put out a tweet, and Hershey and Starbucks were the two that a lot of people were talking about. So be interesting to look at them. But it certainly looks like, in terms of a yield perspective, it looks like there's some value there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yorick has asked us, one third of the portfolio of his portfolio consists of growth stocks, and the rest is in dividend stocks. The growth stocks are the likes of NVIDIA, CrowdStrike, and AMD. they have been flying in recent years, as everyone knows. So his question is, would you sell the highly valued growth stocks and reinvest into dividend stocks? Obviously, there's some tax to consider.
The question is, why do you have those growth stocks in the first place? Yeah, if this is just part of your portfolio mix, why would you sell, right? It's really hard. So I can tell you what I do, yeah, and maybe that helps as a reference. I have always had this thinking of having 10% in non-dividend stocks. Could be value plays, turnarounds, growth stocks. Yeah, I made it less. It's now 3 or 4% because my portfolio has been growing. And effectively, I'm saying, like, okay, for a few thousand is my play money. So what I did, for instance, I bought at the time Meta for 170 euro, and it went to 350 euro. And what I then felt like, okay, it doubled, so I sold half. And let play with the house's money, right? After when you win in the casino, but then it went to $500, and I sold totally out of Meta, because my hypothesis was those stocks, those tech stocks, I sell them, I sell half of it when they are double, and then I let it run. Yeah, but then with Meta at 500, I saw the multiple. I don't have that such a strong conviction of the stock, like I have maybe with Google or something like that. So I sold them out and I cashed out. I just paid the tax. You know, it's okay. You know, the a few certainties in life, right? And I reinvested that in dividend stocks. But I was clear up front why I invested in it, to double the money. Yeah, here, because I thought it was a value play with Meta. Now, I don't know what your reason was for buying those in the first place. Yeah. And that question is, you can only answer, are you a full dedicated dividend growth investor? Then why did you bought them in the first place? If it was a mistake, yeah, maybe it makes sense to sell them then, right? To replace it. If you always want to have a little bit of this, then the question is more of, why do you invest in growth stocks? Is it valuation? Do you believe in the long-term trend? How do you value those stocks? Then what are your rules to sell? So I would first focus on that. Yeah. If you don't know this at the moment, then Ulrich, then write down at what moments in time you sell a growth stock. Is it based on valuation? Is it based because the trend is over? What is it? Based on, if you know this and you have the rules clear, think about when you bought them, what would be the hypothesis for them, and then review with it. And if you then come to the conclusion, oh, I should have actually now sell them. But then the question is, what do you do with the money? Do you invest it in the next growth stock because you want to continue having growth stocks like that, or not? Yeah. Or do you then really focus on dividend growth? I think you need to reversely, how do you say it in English, build your plan. Yeah. Again, of why you invested in them in the first place. That will answer all your questions. You and I can't answer it.
Yeah, I'm going to make some assumptions here, and you asked a couple of questions, but seeing as it is one third of his portfolio, I'm assuming it's a part of his overall strategy. It's not an off the cuff thing. I mean, you have 33% in a growth portfolio. We've had a couple of growth investors on our show, and the one question I've never got a concrete answer to is, when do you sell those growth stocks? We've asked the question a couple of times. We've asked it in various different mannerisms, but I've never been given a concrete answer of when you sell. Yes, the fundamentals change and so on, but never given an actual concrete, because when the fundamentals change, usually it's too late. You're after losing your money. So
exactly, the stock is usually already down 50%.
Yeah. So. I think we're the wrong people. Well, certainly I'm the wrong person to ask about this, because I do not understand when you should sell growth stocks. And that's why I don't invest in growth companies for that reason, because when they're running, we always hear, let your winners run. So what do? You just keep it forever. When do you sell them? So it's a real struggle of me in terms of growth. Yeah. So I understand why.
And for us, it's easy to say, let your winners run, because we want to see growing dividend income, and we don't care really about the principal.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just know that the cash is growing.
Yeah. Well, if you're asking me as a dividend growth investor, what would I do? I would probably invest in dividend growth stocks. So
Yeah, true. But, you know, I find it really hard to say because then we go into financial advice.
Yeah, of course.
And that's something we don't know his situation. We don't know his plan. There's just a question here, like, what would you do?
Yeah. We can only say what we would do, and that's it. Lewis has asked you, first of all, about Spanish paella. What is it like? Have you had any?
Delicious. I mean, for me, fish paella or seafood paella, I mean, come on, guys. Is there anything better here in Spain? No, of course not.
I'm sure the Spanish will be happy to hear that. But the second and part of that question is, what percentage difference have you found in the Q factor, which is your living price, with respect to where you live?
I think there's not a lot of difference between Poland and Spain. It's a gut feel, but I can see, you know, when you're in, I was in the Dolomites skiing. Yeah, I can see there that it's more expensive. But when I'm here in Spain and you're not in the most touristic area, you know what you pay here for tapas or a meal? It's not too far off from in Poland. I have no clue about the housing prices here, but it feels kind of similar, I must say. Probably Spain is a little bit more expensive, but I don't have a feeling like, okay, I need to watch out walking into a restaurant and think twice. Yeah, I don't have that feeling here.
Yeah. So I find that difficult to judge because when I go to Spain, it is usually to a tourist area, and honestly the prices are similar to back home in Ireland, which I know is considerably more expensive than when I was in Poland. And the prices in Poland were ridiculous. I felt like I was saving money when I was spending money over there. So but I find Spain in the areas that I go to, which is touristy, is similar to Ireland. Now you do get your meals cheaper, but it's definitely more expensive than it was 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago when we used to.
Yeah, but it's everywhere. But for instance, you can get a coffee here for €1.5, really delicious.
Yeah, not in the tourist spots where I was. It was not €1.5, but yeah, I mean, I get you. If you can get that, you would not get that in Ireland. Not get that. So Ireland is a notoriously expensive place.
Yeah, but it's the same for me if I go to the city center of Warsaw, and I go there into a coffee bar or I go there to a restaurant, you know they pull your leg. That's what you do with tourists.
Yeah, obviously, of course. That's their cash cows. That's what they're there.
Exactly.
They're there to spend their money, so you might as well take it.
Yeah.
Daniel has asked us, he said, we often quote Charlie and Warren. What percentage of your portfolio is in value and not dividend stocks?
I find that hard to answer. I did classify a few stocks as a turnaround, two or three, like Intel. But generally, I am a value-oriented dividend growth investor. What this means, I don't like to overpay. So I would say that probably 90% of my portfolio was value at the time I bought it. Now, where it is now, clearly Microsoft is not a value now, and it's my second largest position. Shell, I don't find Shell value now. It's my largest position, but at the time of buying, I would say everything had a value component to it. Yeah, because I'm a value oriented growth investor.
And then the second part of that question is, how would a company be priced? How much would it have to be down to grab your attention, despite it not paying a dividend?
Or if it's not paying a dividend, then it's just a matter of, for me, the discounted cash flow valuation and having a reasonable understanding of the probability of them growing the free cash flow. Yeah, having a feeling for it. So it comes then again with conviction. I had this conviction in the beginning with Meta. They were spending everything on these glasses. But I saw the underlying free cash flow. I felt like this can't go too long on like this. And it was a bit of a bet on it. But yeah, I felt quite comfortable working also a bit in the tech industry. So that's how I did it then.
Yeah.
But it was clear. It was a low multiple, 10 or 11 at the time, you know. And you see the ads on Facebook, you see Instagram. I thought, like, come on, guys, this is like a cash machine. Yeah. So it was too obvious for me, Meta, at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Where I struggle with that is at the moment I have a clear goal in mind. I want to reach 100,000, as you know, but like really my goal is dividend income, and I've set myself some goals on that. I've got a relatively small portfolio. I can only put in a certain amount each month, that if I go and deviate from that, I'm deviating from my plan and I'm prolonging my plan. So I don't think I want to look at these types of companies until I'm closer to my financial goals. And then I'll have some wiggle room to say, okay, I've got myself some financial independence, freedom, whatever you want to call it. I can now afford to put that. But because I can only invest so much a month, if I do that in these growth stocks,
you won't make your targets.
I'm deviating from my targets. And then what's going to stop me from doing that every month and not being a dividend growth investor? So that's where my head's at. That's all part of my learnings from COVID.
Exactly.
The next question is from Damien, and he has asked us about a company called Global Water Resources. They've been a dividend payer since they were founded in 2003.
Yeah, so they raised the dividend 14 times since their IPO, but it didn't attract me. I understand why where the interest comes from, because, you know, water, it's becoming even, unfortunately, in also a country of Spain, more and more a scarce resource. So I think there is a solid business in water. But then if you look at the metrics and how it's been growing the dividend, was it 1% or something like that? It's too little for me. It's like not making me excited at all. Yeah, and I don't know the company's plans. Maybe they are revamping their entire business and next year they will grow by 50%. I don't know. But if I look at the history, it doesn't give me an appetite to learn further about it.
Yeah, the dividend growth is certainly low, but it's the type of company that has a certain moat, which you can't copy it.
But I can understand the attractiveness when you know the story of waste management in America. Yeah. Then you may think like, oh, you know, there I missed the boat. Let's look into this one around water. Yeah, but for me personally, it doesn't excite me. So those are my thoughts.
Hussein has asked about external auditors. Do you ever read what they say
about financial reporting? Yes, definitely. And specifically, we were talking about investing in, which one was it again? ADM.
Yes.
Yeah, in ADM, I will not buy any ADM before I've seen the annual report with the auditor's comment. Yeah, not a press release. No, the report and the auditor's comment. I want to see the auditor's comment. I don't know if the report is by now released or not, but that's a great example of a company where you need to read the auditor's comments, because they will seal off on it, or they will tell you all the rest. So, you know, I must confess, not every time when I read the annual report, I go into that section, because there are companies like, I don't know, do you really need to go for, let's say, Johnson & Johnson now into the auditor's comment? I mean, I have studied companies so often, and usually if there would be bad something in the auditor's comments, it would be already online there. I know I should always do it, but I specifically do it like you want to do it now with Bayer, ADM, Medical Properties Trust. That's where you really need to watch the auditor's comments. Yeah. With a priority. You should do it everywhere, but those you should do with a priority.
Mayak has asked us about Universal Music Group. They are on the Amsterdam Exchange, UMG. Have you ever looked at them?
Yeah, so this Maciej, one of our loyal listeners. Hey, Maciej. I know I don't pronounce things very well, but at least Derek knows now that he's talking about you. Universal Music Group, it's a tough one, because I find it a hard business to understand, but you know, they pay a decent dividend. They pay 50% out, I believe, as a dividend policy. So the dividend, at least from what I saw, was a bit lower than the year before. So for me, that's already like a red flag and not interested. I'm looking for dividend growers, or to what many investors sell, then at least a dividend maintainer, but then it needs to be a high yield where you can reinvest those dividends. But for me, this doesn't fit my investment strategy.
Yeah, it looks an interesting type of company. I mean, they have no marketing. They make their money off the likes of Spotify, Apple, kind of music streamers. So the more people stream music, the more they make. I don't know if YouTube would fall into that category, but I can see the appeal behind it. Honestly, I can. I haven't looked at their dividend history or anything like that. But in terms of moat, they have a decent moat. They own 1/3 of the world's music. Music will always be played all over the world. We know artists are complaining about how much money they make. So
yeah,
whether it's sustainable or long-term that they can keep going like this, I don't know. But it certainly has my interest peaked, I would say, at a company like this. But it needs a deep dive to understand, as you said. Janik has asked us about how we calculate when we're able to retire.
Yeah, and he's asking if it's only like the dividend income after tax covering the expenses, or do we also take into consideration pension and portfolio value? For me, it's only the first. And why? My pensions, I know I will get them when I turn 65 or 67. I want to be financially independent earlier or retire earlier. So I will not have access to that money unless I buy off my pension or something like that, but I'm not interested in that. So I see that just as extra money that I will get at the time. Of course, quite significantly. Yeah, let's not forget about that. But because I'm not waiting till I'm 65, I don't include that in my account here, because then you could also argue like, okay, you know, you live now in a certain house, will you stay there? Will you start living smaller later? Do you count this also as money with potential yield behind it? So I'm not looking at it from a net worth point of view. I'm purely looking at it indeed at dividend income after tax, which is nice because dividend income after tax is better, tax than earned income from a job.
Yeah. I'm pretty much the same. I have pension, work pension, but I don't consider it because I want to retire before that. And also we had issues over here, which I spoke about before with pensions. Yeah. So I don't like to rely on that too much. So when it comes along, it will be a bonus. I'll think of it as a nice bonus, but I only use income.
Yeah, same here.
And that is the last question. So thanks to everyone for all the questions. It's been a good show. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will talk to you next week.
Remember, both of us at Dividend Talk are not certified financial specialists through formal education. We are just two guys sharing our journey for inspiration and entertainment purposes. Hence, this is not investment advice. Although we do our best, we can't promise that the information discussed is always correct, nor appropriate for you or anybody else. We always recommend that you do your own due diligence and be accountable for your own choices. As we always say, you can't borrow conviction from others. Last but not least, by listening to our podcast, you agree to hold us harmless from any ramifications, financial or otherwise, that occur to you as a result of acting on information provided in this podcast.